You are listening to The Mystical Positivist. I'm your host, Stuart Gudnick. Joining me is co-host Rob Schmidt. This week on the show, we speak by telephone with spiritual teacher J.J. Gold, author of Just in Time, Autobiographical Stories from an American Spiritual Master, Another Heart in His Hand, A Spiritual Anomaly, and Highway of Diamonds. J.J. Gold has been assisting people in their search for inner meaning for 35 years.
We'll get started with that conversation after a short musical break. We'll be listening to Vittorio Guglielmi on Lyra Viol from a CD called Short Tales for a Viol. This piece by Thomas Mace is called A Labyrinth.
This is The Mystical Positivist, a radio show dedicated to the application of reason in the pursuit of spiritual practice and development. It consists of commentary, book reviews, interviews, and discussion in and around the local and larger spiritual community. The thesis of the show is that rationality is in no way the antithesis of deep mystical experience. In fact, we assert that it is a necessary ally. I'm your host, Stuart Gudnick. Joining me is co-host Rob Schmidt, director of Taiyu Meditation Center and co-founder with myself and Jim Wilson of Many Rivers Books and Tea in Sebastopol. This week on the show, we speak by telephone with spiritual teacher J.J. Gold, author of Just in Time, Autobiographical Stories from an American Spiritual Master, Another Heart in His Hand, A Spiritual Anomaly, and Highway of Diamonds. In his younger years, J.J. Gold studied at a 500-year-old experimental Naqshbandi Sufi school in northeastern Afghanistan. He believed that the methods he learned in this school needed to be modified for people in affluent Western cultures. He took on this challenge, developing tools, dynamics, and explorations of consciousness to help lead Westerners toward intimacy with ultimate reality in order to become true servants. J.J. Gold has been assisting people in their search for inner meaning for 35 years. He is currently living in the Sierra foothills of Northern California, where he works with several dozen seekers of truth. Over the years, he has deliberately resisted the trend to becoming a traveling guru with thousands of followers around the world in favor of preserving an element that he considers precious, that of maintaining opportunities for developing an actual teacher-student relationship. He is available for anyone who seeks his guidance. Justin Gold, welcome to The Mystical Positivist.
Good to be here. Good to be here. Welcome to my living room.
Thank you.
Well, welcome to our studio. And we'll begin, as we do most of these interviews, by inviting you to cast your mind back to your childhood and youth, and if any particular moment or experience comes up that, and in retrospect, you would say prefigured the direction your life would go, I invite you to share it with our audience. I know, having read much of Just in Time, that there were a lot of such moments that you write about extensively, but if anything comes up in the moment here, let us know.
Well, I had a relatively unique upbringing in the Bronx,
We're having some technical difficulties here with your signal. I'm wondering if we need to change over to the different telephone number that we have for you. Can you hear?
Maybe I can speak a little louder. Is that
that's better? That's
yeah. I think the problem is we're cutting out a little bit every now and then.
Right. So go ahead and resume, and we'll see if this works.
Very difficult to say which elements are produced the effects that I would have wanted to produce. I'd say in general, everything bad ever happened to me. Positive and every good that ever happened to me was other than that.
We missed enough of the enough of your voice cut out there that I don't actually know quite what you just said. So I'm thinking we might have to change telephones. Is that a feasible thing for you on your end?
Yes, it is. Let me try this.
Okay.
Hello, is this better?
Yeah, that's better. I think what you were using might be a voice level sensitive mic, so it cuts out if the voice level goes down.
Is it better?
It's better, although it's still cut out just a little bit again. Why don't you just say something? Speak another sentence,
still
and let's see.
The music in the back.
Okay, that might be some of the conceivably some of
all
the
right.
issue.
That's better.
Okay. Well, I'm certainly used to being misunderstood, so I am not traumatized at all by this.
We're off to a great start here.
Yeah, really. Anyway, so we missed the gist of what you started with, but I picked up a little bit at the end of both good things and bad things happened.
Yes, certainly, and it's difficult to project which things had which effects, but my upbringing was relatively unique in that my family situation was multi-ethnic and immigrant, second generation, and numerous people coming and going, and that certainly had an effect on my ability and my comfort level of being around a lot of people, which has been the focus of my life, really. In terms of my spiritual upbringing, it started quite late for me, and I was an average kid, wanting to do what average kids do. But eventually, I tired of some of those things and moved on to more of a life of depth, and here we are.
Got it. Well, I'm intrigued because my teacher used to say that one of the really important things for people who might eventually aspire to engage in what he thought of as real spiritual practice is actually to have a lot of varied impression food, and the earlier the better. So it sounds like you were fortunate in that sense to have this relatively unique background that you just mentioned.
Yeah, I very much agree with that premise. I've seen over the years that people that prematurely get into spiritual pursuits, usually for what I might call hiding from life, have the maximum experience that they can have of success in hiding from life, and that there is a projection, which you might call a boomerang-type parabola, where there is a going out, and in that going out period, which incorporates youth and probably quite a bit after that, a person has to become bigger. A person has to explore, find their own way of feeling important, finding significance. And that's as it should be. And for a person to get involved with spirituality, which is really a process of becoming less, would be premature until such a time as a person feels that that first phase is becoming repetitious and then coming home becomes more relevant.
Well, that's interesting because, of course, you one of the chapters in Just in Time is named The Boomerang, I think, and I quite resonated with that chapter, probably because I'm 64 now and I've been feeling the last few years as if I'm on the return trajectory of the boomerang in a certain sense. But it's also intriguing to me what you just said, because you know, I started spiritual practice at age 24, and Stuart actually same thing.
Yeah.
Excuse me. So, I think for me the thing was I had no prospect of my life getting better. I had no illusion that I was going to find satisfaction in the ordinary pursuits of the world. But I didn't, I as it were, fell into spiritual practice. That is, I met my teacher in a context where I had no right or expectation to meet something like, and no intention of getting involved in spiritual practice. So I guess in response to what you said, it sounds like there's a variety of different ways to
yes,
to arrive at that place.
I also met a teacher when I was 24 that I really understood what was the relationship was questionable. I found him curious. I found him interesting. I found him entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
But the level of my recognizing what our connection was took a while.
Mm. I see.
I'm interested to know to what extent that there's a flavor of that in your book, Another Heart in His Hand.
Yes, well, so Another Heart in His Hand is a combination of actuality and projection. So the sick element of the story is accurate, but there was no poker-playing teacher.
Mm-hmm.
The poker-playing teacher was a synthesis of me and this man that I met at some time, whose name was Raya, but I call him Ray in Another Heart in His Hand.
Yeah.
And I wanted to put forth some ideas in an entertaining and different context, which is poker playing. So I did. That was an interesting experiment. His latest book is actually factual.
Well, I wanted to mention in Another Heart in His Hand, just a few comments about that, because I found it very engaging. But it's one of the few books I've come across that really captures, at least for me, what was part of my experience in working with my teacher. There, it really beautifully both captures the dance, the relationship, the going deeper, and the nature of certainly what was emphasized in our own path, for which was somewhat related to the fourth way, about putting focus on the small moments in life and using the small moments in life as an occasion for teaching. And I also wanted to mention an anecdote about the book that came up, because I've been reading it this week and I've been on a business trip for my day job, and I was on an airplane with a group of people. Normally on an airplane I do the typical business traveler thing, which is kind of plug in or read a book or do something to just kind of have the time pass by. But I was sitting next to a woman who was kind of engaged and very chatty, and she, as I pulled out Another Heart in His Hand, she said, "Oh, what are you reading?" So I proceeded to tell her. And that started this fascinating, deep conversation with her, because it was, you know, the ideas about avoidance, the ideas about what it means to actually be engaged in a practice were resonating with her. And then she pulled out a book that she had, that she'd been reading, and says, "This is what I'm reading." And it says, "How Not to Give an F," which is some new modern book about, you know, essentially letting go of some of the concerns that people have that hold them back from realizing what they want in their lives. But then as we were talking, the person next to us who was sitting at the window began to engage, because something in our conversation touched him and related to an experience he had in kind of overcoming a desire as an ex-drinker to have a drink that morning, when a drink was presented to him that reminded him of his grandmother. And so this whole conversation basically took place on this long flight, and it started to affect people around us as well. And what struck me about that, and I'll turn this back to you to respond, is, you know, there was real power in that relationship that you described, and there's real power in the book, and that power had the capacity of leaping essentially off the page and waking up this crowd of people in this otherwise relatively tuned out and plugged in context. And suddenly people's hearts were engaged and people were engaging with each other in a way which was uncommon for all of them. And I wanted to relay that because it was a very beautiful experience that's connected directly with actually having engaged with this material.
Uh-huh. Well, that certainly is reassuring, and I understand how the positivist part comes in your in the name of your show. I do, really, the reason that I wrote the book is this latest book, and really the ones before it as well, has a lot less to do with attracting people than having some historical context for being reminded of what's important in whatever place a person has that they keep those memories and those impressions. And those that reaction or action to whatever I've read might be take place to this generation or a following one or a following one. And I appreciate the importance of that, because that element of literature and songs and poems and movies have been really important to me, not so much in teaching me what to do and what one can do and what one shouldn't do, but more in reminding me what's important to me and being an inspiration in my practice.
Got it.
Well, I'm wondering, you know, that there's such a variety of stories that you write about from your life, from you know autobiographically from your life in Just in Time, and I don't want to be too simplistic in my response, but I'm curious if you have more to say about your own training. I don't know if that lies as in the material that Stuart pulled off, whatever website he pulled it off, that describes your background and studies in a Naqshbandi Sufi school and so forth, or if it extends beyond that. But I'm curious to hear about what you might say about that and how that articulated through your life at whatever time it started to do. You've already mentioned that at age 24 you weren't apparently tuning into some of the stuff that you later came to embody in your life.
So, I think I would probably describe the early period as a period of seduction where everyone was being nice to me that I came in contact with in terms of spiritual instruction. And once I started to understand what was happening, the period of being knocked around mercilessly proceeded.
My teacher used to call it the roses and then the thorns periods.
Well, I've come to value the thorns and try to pass it on to people that I have contact with, but it's definitely a challenge, because our time is definitely a time of roses, more roses. A good part of instruction that I absorbed and still value is understanding that meditation and any really spiritual aspiration starts at a relatively fine place. It doesn't start at the place of reaction to negativity and restlessness and competition and those places. Those facilities are really important and part of the going out process and the competition and the striving and the becoming substantial. But for the coming home part, it really is necessary to leave some of those obstacles behind. So a good part of my study were the moment-to-moment difficulties that I had that I became to recognize where coarseness is in me, and the idea of sitting down to meditate on inner light and inner sound, inner vibration, anything that was yielded the possibility of going further in and further up and further in, was fanciful to me, because there was so much weight around, not so much that I was a ponderous personality or that I was an extreme worrier, but recognizing that life, ordinary life, is really a sequence of what I might call falling off and the relief of coming back, or feeling some minutia of negativity and needing to do something to relieve myself of that negativity. And that doesn't happen just a few times a day, but happens perpetually. So really the study of that and leaving some of that behind was what I remember really to be the most significant part of the training that I had and the exposure I had to people who understood that process.
One of the things that I was struck by your writing was the freshness of the language, because some of those ideas are certainly found in some of the technical jargon of traditions. I think I've seen that elements of that in Sufi tradition, but certainly in the Fourth Way tradition there are analogies. But the language you used was very accessible. Like for instance, what I got from your framing of the problem was, in very ordinary words, that there are these obstacles that you've just been describing that sort of stand between us and the source of in our lives, or the source of our lives. And you describe them as clouds, and that a lot of the work is really certainly preliminary work, if not a large portion of the work, is trying to somehow address those obstacles.
Yes, it's really... It's interesting that you mentioned the simplicity of words and vocabulary, because we're really in a very different time, and this idea, I don't know if you know the Paul Simon song American Tune, but we are an American tune here, and my students are part of that American tune, and the idea of bringing historic methods and historic nomenclature into our American tune only means that we're incapable or unable to recreate that in the present. And I have been able to recreate that in the present only because the combination of training and personal experience and understanding that's come from that has allowed me to develop a vocabulary from that American tune. And after all, words are for exploration. They're not so much for explanation. And really to understand the difference between naming something and thinking that in naming something you really captured some part of the essence of that experience, whether it's skiing or whether it's love, it's all vocabulary. We do understand that from numbers. Nobody would say 4, 7, 9 and think they've really described anything unless they were referring to what the 4, 7, and 9 is. And, numbers are a vocabulary, are letters in the vocabulary of numbers, as letters are letters in the vocabulary of words. So we have, and I have made it a point to develop a specific language which is created from our experience and what we have come to understand, along with the stories and the songs that are current for our life and meaningful for our life, because the similarities between the control factor, the control element that existed at the time, whether it's of the Sufis or Islam in its birth or the Buddha, the times are so drastically different in terms of the elements of control. And to think that we would conceive of not wanting to return again, which has been historically the lure of people who lived really hard lives, that you won't have to return again. Well, there's nobody here that wants to leave in the first place.
That is a darn good point.
That is a different problem. Yeah, you raise an interesting question that I'm interested in your experience of that. Is it language? Is it the frame that is important for creating a context for the modern mind, the modern spiritual seeker, or, you know, the converse is that it doesn't, in some ways it doesn't matter what the frame is, there will always be a certain subsection of the population that has a yearning for something beyond what the, as you put it, the horizontal realm of life offers, and that regardless of what form is presented, people will make their way towards that. And so I guess I'm interested in that. The contrasting point of view is that, you know, how critical is it to have a contemporary language versus the idea that it almost doesn't matter what the language is, it's just always going to be a certain subsection of people who are driven and yearning for this kind of work?
Well, if you notice in my book, I'm reticent to use technical language. I would rather project the importance of a fairy tale, because in a fairy tale or in a song or in a movie whose impressions are really subjective, a person can extract and withdraw what they see, and because you really don't have access to the author or the songwriter or the movie director or writer and say, what do you mean by this, what do you mean by this, what do you mean by this? So we get what we want, especially from fairy tales, which are abstract. We extract what's real to us. So in my general talking to people in books I write, I would prefer to convey what I'm saying through a story. And I think that the stories that I tell in this last book, really autobiographical stories, the element of extracting teaching, and even in the travel adventure book, Highway of Diamonds that I wrote, there is that element of extracting the lessons that is real to a person, that may be real to a person. But amongst the people that I directly deal with, that the necessity for a precise language, I think, is elemental. The same as in a cooking school, if you say, pass the tarragon, you would expect to be past the tarragon. So I wouldn't expect that precision to be necessary for talking to people in general, but I have considered the importance of developing a precise language for people I directly work with in our interchanges with each other.
Got it. You're listening to The Mystical Positivist. I'm your host, Stuart Gudnick. Joining me is co-host Rob Schmidt. This week on the show, we speak by telephone with spiritual teacher J.J. Gold, author of Just in Time, Autobiographical Stories from an American Spiritual Master, Another Heart in His Hand, A Spiritual Anomaly, and Highway of Diamonds. J.J. Gold has been assisting people in their search for inner meaning for 35 years.
So I was really interested in what you just said a moment ago about language and stories, and using stories, and although your language is very straightforward in the book Just in Time, there's also this very interesting interweaving of your own direct personal experience, which then you relate to in a number of cases other stories. And what came to my mind was the Escape from Alcatraz chapter. Where you outline I won't go into all the details, but you end up talking about the movie Escape from Alcatraz because you've just read this story that the guy whose life the movie is based on and was presumed to have died, actually 40 years later there's somebody in Ireland claiming to be that guy, and that he and these other two brothers escaped. And you use that as a metaphor to describe the relationship between spiritual aspirants and spiritual teachers. And I think I think it might be nice to talk about just that one point, but I also want to focus on the use of story, because you're right that you use a very... relevant modern examples to write from, as I just was pointing out. But then the device of stories, it seems to me, is immemorial in many spiritual traditions. So by all means, talk a little bit more about this point that you make. But also, I'm wondering if you see it the way I do, that there is this thing about stories that connects to the human psyche in a way that allows for understandings to pass.
Yes, I definitely agree with that. The problem I see with historic stories, which usually start with there was a farmer in the field, is that most of the farmers in the fields that I know are not growing corn and potatoes.
Mm-hmm.
If you get my drift.
Yep.
What I do see is that we should be able to develop our own stories, because we're no longer farmers in the field, but I think that if I was going to write the Tibetan Book of the Dead, I would write the Tibetan Book of Embarrassment. Because, as I've said, embarrassment is a little death.
Mm-hmm.
And embarrassment is historical and has always taken place within the human psyche and within the human reaction. But our experience of slipping on the carpet in a plane and hoping nobody sees us is a little death that really didn't take place 1,000 years ago and 2,000 years ago. Mm. So my wish, really, and in writing some of these stories, that some of these stories are really meaningful to me because they were learning processes for me. And a lot of the focus from my teacher, or my first teacher, was making it available for me to learn how to learn. He really didn't try to teach me any specifics. He taught me how to see what was in the way for me learning what was right in front of me. So I have learned that, and if I have a unique expertise, it is in doing that particular thing, and that skill is something that I am not able to pass on, but I am able to pass on direction in seeing what's in the way from us learning what's directly in front of us, because in my opinion, no greater school has been or will ever be created than human life. It's so varied. There are every step of personality is represented in a fairly narrow grouping of people: externals, internals, nature, cities, money, sexuality. Everything is presented to us, and it's presented to us not only in macrocosm, it's presented to us in its microcosm, in its moments. And if we can really develop the ability or uncover the ability to be present and to witness those moments, the learning process really opens up. So my to go back to the point and the idea of stories and fairy tales, one of the fairy tales that I so much value is called The Last Unicorn. It's a very simple book, which could be considered a children's book.
Peter Beagle,
Peter Beagle.
Yeah.
And it really could be considered to have nothing to do with spirituality, but that story, in a way, is a modern-day Sufi story. And I'm hoping the stories that I am telling are modern-day Sufi stories as well.
Well, this is very interesting to me because so one of the points from Just in Time that is pretty clear, it's not present in every chapter, but you're sometimes willing to tell a story about how they're not flattering. It's not necessarily a flattering thing. So the particular thing I'm chapter I'm thinking about is Cat Hair and Ground Glass, where I forget what it's called, because I know of this practice that you used to do where you would drive a car for someone someplace.
Drive away cars.
Yeah, that's right. Drive away cars. So so you got into this. You had to leave to accomplish your purposes. You had to take this car that you thought was full of cat hair, to which you had learned that you were quite allergic. And so you're driving through the mountains with the windows open, and you are inadequately clothed, so you're freezing. And you know, it's not a flatter, it's not a flattering thing. And then you say, and you use this as this wonderful direct example of how all of us do these things. And you know, and when I was reading it, I could think of, you know, similar stories in my own life. So and that seems to me to be a different kind of story. Tell me, correct me if I'm wrong here, but it seems to me that that's a different kind of story, except maybe the Mullah Nasruddin, you know, oeuvre. But often it's, you know, the way that spiritual practice and understanding is conveyed in a lot of stories doesn't have that element of revelation
or
that
vulnerability.
Or vulnerability, that's a good word. That these wonderful modern stories that you're relating do. Does that make any sense to you, or does that...
Certainly does. It would be unrealistic for me to present any progression. My first stories start when I was maybe 7 years old, and in that story about wanting to know where my friend gets the quarters.
Yeah, that's a great story.
All the time, and I think that's one of my favorite stories. And I certainly didn't understand at the time what was there, and I certainly didn't understand the nature of what I was capable of doing in terms of that ground glass and cat hair, but. It would be unrealistic to tell a progression of things and start off with how wise I was, because I certainly wasn't. In some cases, I was oblivious. In some cases, I was numb, and probably more numb than oblivious. And certainly, I was an ordinary kid desperately trying to feel okay and feeling like I belonged and all those things. And
right. That
it would be unrealistic and fanciful to present a progression that didn't start there, because we do start there. Now, it is possible for us not to end there. And that's why that if all the stories began and ended with with that level of consciousness, that level of awareness, it would be a tragic book, not what I would write. But certainly it's realistic to begin there.
Well, what I appreciate about that is when what I'm suggesting is that, you know, the book seems, you know, straightforward and is very accessible. And yet there's a sophistication in the contextualization, like that story you just referred to, although you didn't mention the title of the chapter, Wurzel the Turtle, which you know, about this this way that you didn't understand how the relation, how, I mean, there's several things in this chapter which are wonderful. I actually was relating it to, we had a dinner party last night with some spiritual teachers and authors, and I was relating that chapter because I was so taken by it. So maybe actually you could actually relate that story, because I think it has some incredibly powerful stuff in it.
For me, certainly it does, and historically it's a story that continues to have meaning. The basic principle of the story is when I was 7 or 8 years old, living in the Bronx as I did and walking to school, I was fairly independent. And one of the things that independent kids did on the weekend was go to the movies, which was about an equal distance to my school, but walking through the streets of the city. And movies at that time cost a quarter, and I didn't. Sometimes I had accessibility to that quarter, and sometimes I didn't. But I had a friend whose name was Wurzel, and I don't remember his first name because, as I said in the story, when you have a name like Wurzel, you only need one name.
So, indeed.
I'm apologizing to Wurzel if he ever gets to listen to this interview.
Really?
So he always had the quarter, and he was generous enough to involve me and allow me to, as part of his generosity, to go along with him to the movies. So Wurzel and the Turtle always got, and I always got to go to the movies together. But I didn't understand how he could always have a quarter and I couldn't. And he told me very simply, I take the newspapers down. So I proceeded to think, oh, well, I have a new source of income. So I, the next time I was in my apartment house, because that's the nature of life in the Bronx, everybody lives in apartment houses, not private houses. And there's a basement where all the, a dark and dulgy place where all the garbage and the newspapers, not to be recycled, but to be I don't know what. So I, the next time I went, wanted a quarter, I gathered up the newspapers from my apartment, and I took them downstairs, and I was waiting for the quarter to be forthcoming, and it wasn't. My understanding was that there was some automatic or mechanical or direct link between taking the newspaper down and getting a quarter. But I came to understand after questioning him several times and still not getting the quarter that it was connected more with the relationship with my grandmother that wanted me to have the quarter. So I was a beneficiary more, I was to be, and Wurzel was a beneficiary more of her generosity and her caring for him than the actual newspapers and the basement. And this is a monumental lesson for a human being to recognize that the relationships that we imagine are happening for us, and whatever the finer energy and the finer material that keeps our hearts going and our ability to think, are not quite what we imagine them to be. That no one watches a TV. People watch the program on a TV. And this is very important to understand, that no one would sit in front of a blank TV, even though we say, I'm going to watch TV, unless there was something of attraction that was being transmitted by the TV, and that we are also transmitters. We're receivers and interpreters and transmitters, and that is actually what we value in each other and don't really understand that, because when our eyes fix on a body and a face, we start attributing to that body and the face something more tangible than the actuality of those people are receivers, interpreters, and transmitters of potentially very fine energy, but also often very coarse energy. And it's not the person themselves that can be held to that, but actually, similar to a TV, you wouldn't throw away the TV because the programs weren't right. You would look for deeper programs. And the same way as we're communicating through a radio, if a person is listening to their radio, they certainly don't imagine the radio is producing either your voice or my voice.
And the thing that I really, one of the points that you further elaborate in that chapter is the notion that the universe actually wants to help us. In other words, that's a simplistic way to put it, perhaps, but it's not quite as grim a situation necessarily as a lot of people tend to think.
No, I'm in a position to be very optimistic because not only do I work with people that are interested and feeling and have and live with those people and work with those people and people that are accepting that there is a naturalness beneath all the obstacles that is rich and deep and benevolent, and that really our job is to remove the obstacles. We don't really have to create goodness, that there is goodness. And I don't see this as a philosophy. I see this as a tangible discovery that I have made growing up in New York City and having all the equipment that goes along with that, which is basically cynicism. So having gone from that position of cynicism and thinking that basically everyone is full of shit to knowing that everyone is full of shit, but only on the surface of things.
Well, it's that idea that the universe wants to help us, as clarified in the story of Wurzel the Turtle, is interesting from the aspect that so often today people are enmeshed with, who are interested in spiritual practice, have all the techniques in the world, and it's you point to something different. You can practice lots of techniques, but that's not how you're going to get the quarter. You know, ultimately the techniques aren't bad in and of themselves, but I understand you to say that it's the relationship with the grandmother, as it were, that is the force that wants to help us. It's that relationship that really is critical or key to going deeper, and that actually grabbing onto technique can be a reification of doing it myself and doing it all by myself and being in control of the process rather than surrendering to something that has our best interests in heart.
Well, surrendering is an interesting word because in some cultures, it historically, surrendering is presented as an admirable trait. In our culture, our picture of surrender is the guys with the hands in the air and the terrible look on their face of defeat.
Yes.
I don't think we have a supplemental concept of surrender that has been either assimilated or taught by our culture. But the nature, as you say, of the return, once we have tasted enough of life that we really feel that the next taste, although it could be varied because the potential in our life is very varied, that even though it may be varied, it could be repetitious and probably will be repetitious. And once we have that feeling, the process of control that's so needed on that journey out has to be reexamined. And that's a tremendous challenge because it's worked for us, and the amount of control really equals the amount of success that we've had in our societal understanding of the going out process. But on the way home, it really has to be recognized that our mastery of techniques and our conquest of obstacles and our feeling of being on top of it is both inappropriate and not constructive, and really in this case self-destructive, because we, in order to feel the actuality of meditation, we have to become less and less and less and less, because the energy that maintains us was there before. It was there before everything was added on. And if we're going to go back to the simplicity and the elimination and the leaving behind of those obstacles, that experience of inner reality is going to be a product of our becoming less. Less personality, less control, less manipulation. And that is a process of recognizing the grandmother that is benevolent and being able to sublimate ourselves to that grandmother, which is a tremendous challenge for the Western culture. There is no greater challenge than the recognition of the value of being less than.
It's amazing that our culture is completely constituted for taking on more. You know, we learn things, we add knowledge, and many people's at least initial relationship to spiritual practice is all about getting more. It certainly was the case for me. I expected I was going to get control and power when I first got involved in spiritual work, and I remember the first moments when I had inklings that wasn't the case. It was more like a deflation, like, oh no, this isn't what I thought it was. Is this really worth doing?
Very challenging, and that's where the idea of some intermediary person representing a training ground for that being less than was tremendously confronting. I couldn't even use the word confronting. It was extremely unattractive to me. It was anathema to me, actually, at what it was. So my relationship with this first person that I met, that I'm calling my teacher, was that he saw me as I was, but I had to pretend like we were buddies, because I couldn't accept the fact that there would be someone who was more of a human being than I, even though I was almost a teenager at that time. So I went on with that concept and that construct, not recognizing the potential value in having someone in my life that was not mechanically recognized as more of a human being, not in essence, but in accomplishment. But eventually, in spending a protracted time with him, really with him, and that's why I say the most important element of a person in that position is someone who can pass the salt to you and mail a letter for you. Because if that person isn't really with you and you can play good in the moments that you see that person and the few times a year that you're with that person, you can play devotee or you can play student. If you're not really in that position where you're seeing the actual mastery of someone and the actual relaxed comfort and humanity and generosity of a person, then you really don't have the opportunity to feel less than. And so many people, as we're talking about in our culture, don't want to see that, and I didn't want to see that, but because of exposure, it became so materially obvious to me that I was in the presence of someone who had something that I didn't have. And it became acceptable to me to be under. And, you know, as they say, I didn't make it up, and I'm reluctant to say something, but to stand under is to understand.
Well, I like that formulation. You also have in the Wurzel der Turzel chapter a sentence that is in italics, which is, as necessary as our efforts are, they are not the most important thing. And I think in some ways that kind of underscores the importance of what you just said, because if we accept that our efforts will not, as we've been doing them and as we know how to do them, will not create the demonstration that we see enacted by someone like this person you called your teacher, there's no place to look for help. There's no way to receive the help. So I certainly get the, you know, as my teacher emphasized, I get how utterly crucial it is to have that demonstration in your life of these principles, not just when people are on a stage, not just when, you know, because, you know, most people can present something of an attractive appearance, you know, more or less for different people, but when you meet someone who's always acting from generosity as far as you can see, that's unusual, that's remarkable, and that's something that is not encountered frequently. So then the question is, how do people find that that person in their lives? And we only have 3 minutes until the break.
Then we'll have more time.
Right, then we'll have more time.
If I had an answer to that question, I could probably put it in 3 minutes.
Right.
I have.
Me too.
That question is, there are so few people that are sincerely looking that I, in our culture, because the challenges of being presented with every possible permutation of relief and success and upliftment are not only presented to us in the world of ordinary life and acquisition and competition, but are presented to us in the world of New Age spirituality, which is a tremendous problem for us, because there are the misunderstanding is proliferated that one does can do it themselves, that one can get relief, that one can fix themselves, and I have never been successful. I have had at a maximum 50 people, maybe 60 people or 70 people that I have dealt with, and right now I have more like 30, and I wouldn't know how to deal with more people than that. And really, to be accurate, I would say half of those people are just trying to figure out what they're looking for.
Sure.
And it is a interesting thing that you know, our own teacher had a very small community, and it was the intimacy and the 24/7 nature of the relationship that was critical. And when I think of a community where there's a teacher with 1,000 students, it becomes so easy to hide. It's so easy to hide in the hierarchy, so easy to hide in the crowd, it doesn't even seem to be possible for that to be anything other than just the very initiatory of possibilities. And on that note, it is we are at a time for our break, so we're going to take a short break at the hour, and I'll let you get off the phone and chat with Rob for a moment here.
Okay.
You are listening to The Mystical Positivist. I'm your host, Stuart Gudnick. Joining me is co-host Rob Schmidt. This week on the show, we speak by telephone with spiritual teacher J.J. Gold, author of Just in Time, Autobiographical Stories from an American Spiritual Master, Another Heart in His Hand, A Spiritual Anomaly, and Highway of Diamonds. J.J. Gold has been assisting people in their search for inner meaning for 35 years.
We'll return to our show after a short musical break. We'll be listening to Vittorio Guglielmi on bass viol from a CD called Short Tales for a Viol. This piece by an anonymous composer is called Gemya. Thank you.